So let's start at the top of my curiosity. Please tell me about your name, Raghu Marcus.
Where did I get that name?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that opens a whole kennel of worms, right?
Good.
And you'll have to tell me what, how far you want me to go in and out of this stuff.
Okay? Oh, go too far.
Obviously,
man. Go
I got that. Not obviously, but I did get that name, which is a nickname. My full the full name that I use is Raghavendra Das, which means servant of the Lord of the Raghus, which is another name for Ram, the god Ram. There's Krishna, Ram, Shiva in the Hindu pantheon. And so Neem Karoli Baba gave me that name. And then when I got on a train soon after I got it, I was with Indian people. Everybody's really friendly in India. And they said, "What is your good name?" And I said, "Raghavendra Das," thinking, "Wow, this is so great. I've got an Indian name, Indians." And they went, "Excuse me?" They didn't get it. It was too much of a mouthful, even for Indians. In that moment, it became Raghu, which is also the name that Ram, the dynasty of Ram, is the race of the Raghus, which is the sun race. So that's where it came from. Now, in the end, as crazy as this is, 10 minutes later, we call him Maharaji, Neem Karoli Baba, the man in the blanket. He said, "Sundar Shyam Das," like, "That's your name." And Shyam is another name for Krishna. And Krishna is the beautiful blue flute player who engages all of the gopis, the gals that milk the cows, and they just do nothing but wait for Krishna to appear because they are lost in love with him. And in fact, there's something in the book about Krishna's Leela, his play, where one night it's called Ras Leela every year. In this case, there was 100,000 of these gopis, and he made love to each one of them. It was like, it's this fantastic, romantic, erotic kind of thing. Anyhow, my wife-to-be at the time said, "Nah, he doesn't want that name. He wants the Ram name." That was the end of that. So I have assumed that name all these years. Now, of course, how did I get there in the first place is a whole other question.
Yeah, and also, what does that mean to a kid from Canada? To go to India, to get a new name, what does that symbolize? What does that mean to you?
I was like any other. I mean, I was totally into psychedelics, right? I was into media because I was program director of a rock and roll radio station in Montreal in the late 60s into 1970. And I had some familiarity with Eastern mysticism. Yeah, but mostly I was saved because of Bob Dylan, because I just hated the culture and I hated being controlled and I hated, what are you supposed to be somebody now? You know? And then, of course, Dylan, it was okay, yeah, that's it, Bob. He's expressing what many of us are feeling. So there was some spaciousness in my life as a result of music, actually. That was a big thing for me. I saw my first really incredible experience of out-of-body experience without psychedelics was seeing John Coltrane live in Montreal when I was like 16 or 17. And he played my... Do you know who John Coltrane
For
is?
Sure.
Yes, of course you do. He played My Favorite Things. And I just went out. I don't know what happened, but I'll never forget it to this moment. So as time went on, I was looking. There has to be something else. So I was at the radio station, and the secretary called in and said, "Hey, somebody here wants to talk to you about a lecture at McGill University, the big university in Montreal." And I said, "Okay." So they said, "Oh, yeah, would you mind promoting Ram Das? He's giving a lecture at McGill University." And I'm going, "Ram Das? What's that?" He said, Richard Alpert, Tim Leary? I went, oh, I love them, because I was right in the thick of that culture, right? But I said, okay, but send me a tape. You must have some tape of him giving a lecture. They sent it over to the radio station. I went into a studio, and every word was like, for anybody who's listened to the first time to Ram Dass, you know, the sense of, okay, this truth, I believe this guy. You kind of, just through his tonal quality and his voice and his presence through the tape. Mm. So I said, I gotta meet him. So they arranged it. I literally ran out and met him. And he opened the door. Nobody was in there. He was in some house in Montreal. And he opened the door. And suddenly, right in front of me, you know, we're a few feet away right now. Well, half that distance, like right there, he contacted me with these incredible blue saucers of eyes. And all around me was just a field of caring, like I was the only person left on the planet, okay? Total attention, just, you know, what can I do for you kind of thing, without saying a word. We just were in eye contact for a couple of minutes, you know, and he just dropped that, no Ram Dass, no Richard Alpert, and just dropped into the book that he had not written at that time called Be Here Now. I experienced that completely. And out of that, I had total trust. I had a trust that I hadn't had before with anybody. And that trust led me to India. And he was going to go, and I said, I'm coming. He said, well, I can't tell you anything, because he wasn't supposed to talk about Neem Karoli Baba. Of course, that's all he did. He said, well, I had a jewel. How could I... I couldn't not tell people. I couldn't not share it, which is really his legacy. You know, he's now, it's 2.5 weeks ago he left, so it's not even that long ago. Mm. So I did go there. He did get me to the right address, shall we say. And then as soon as I sat there, as soon as I met Neem Karoli Baba, I've known you forever. You know, there was nothing new about it. I knew deep inside me I had known this person, this being, or whatever that was being emitted. And the first thought that came to me, okay, I'm home. I'm cool now. I'm home, you know. And then that's what Ram Dass was all about. I knew that he was just an open channel for whatever that thing is, which we have no real understanding, because it was an it rather than, there was nothing going back and forth like all of the people that we meet in life on a date, including our parents and anybody, where it's a two-way street, you know. We are relating to a somebody, and they are relating. This was a nobody, which begs to this, you know, the movie I just mentioned to you, Becoming Nobody, which Ram Dass did in that moment with me. He absolutely, all the me-ness left, me, left. There was nothing that he was interested in from me. It was only, what can I do for you? Mm. And it was that pool of kind of unconditional love, which is what we got that moment that I met Neem Karoli Baba. So everything that happened after that, names and all the miracles and all of that, was just really about completely destroying this idea that I am this thing that's in my head. And he did that on a constant day-to-day basis by telling us shit that nobody could know about our lives. Not just past, present, but the future. So it was like a very, very immediate way for us to get over ourselves, really. You know, we just could not then believe in the ego mind story that, you know, we had been telling ourselves all these years. And we were young. We were all, you know, between 18 and 25.
Yeah.
You know, so that's crazy too. And we only saw him the last 3 years of his life. And how many people? Maybe 250 Westerners total. I mean, you see these gurus that come every, you know, especially here to the States. You know, these enormous following. So but what happened was considerable, considering what Ram Dass did.
And do you think that what you experienced with Ram Dass when you
when you met him for the first time, that sense of being seen, was that the same feeling you got when you met Neem Karoli Baba? Was that the same thing contacting you or communicating with you?
I would say yes to that in the way that when we talk about truth, there's only one truth. So his Ram Dass being with me in that moment, a presence was just, it came from the truth, whatever we want to call that thing, you know, God, you know, I don't love that word. I like divine presence, actually. Yeah. That's not bad. Yeah. Anyhow, the truth, though. Yeah, so it all comes from the same place. On the other hand, Ram Dass was not living in that place 24/7. He was not, you know, in terms of, you know, 10 minutes later, he might have, you know, gotten cranky at the, you know, the guy that was giving him the microphone at the lecture, God knows what. But the reality is, yeah, Neem Karoli Baba was what they call in India a siddha, a completely finished being. There's no subject-object going on whatsoever. And I've never met anybody like that except Anandamayima, who is another great saint in India, and the 16th Karmapa, who in the Tibetan tradition is, there's the Dalai Lama, the Karmapa, the Panchen Lama and the Karmapa are the three of the great beings that reincarnate, you know, from life to life. Mm. And I did have his darshan meeting with him, 16th Karmapa. And when I got real close to him, because it was going to be individual, he puts this silk scarf, if you've ever seen the Tibetan stuff. Yeah. And as soon as I got close to him, I said, holy shit, this is Maharaj, this is Neem Karoli Baba. Whatever that thing is, was in that body pool, whatever it was. So it's a pretty rare thing to no longer be in subject-object and have prescience and all that stuff. So, yeah, that Ram Dass did not have that.
A friend of mine calls that act getting out of the way of your... Getting out of the way. Getting out of the way. And being able to make place or make space for that thing or that something to communicate through you. And that connects, I think, with what you said about being nobody, getting
totally.
Rid of that.
Yep. Getting out of the
baggage.
Way. Yeah. I mean, and we can all do that. We all can do that. We can do the practices that are necessary to kind of leverage yourself out of the belief systems that you've been subjected to from parents to teachers to culture to all of it, from past lives as well. So that's necessary and all possible. A being like a Neem Karoli Baba, that is not possible necessarily. Certainly, you know, this is a gazillion lifetimes or whatever. I don't know how it works, but certainly that's a different level of it all completely.
Yeah, I mean, and he seemed to me like a person who was very clear on his... on his path and what to do. He was 12 when he started to consider himself walking the path of a sadhu when he was 11, 12.
Yeah, you know, he took off and he went into, you know, different. It's funny, you know, it seems like these beings when they come in with what they got. They are he is that thing.
Right.
And then but they seem to have the body be able to encompass it. So they need to do long meditation stints in caves. He did long one in a lake. Mm. He just sat in a lake for some time. And then that happened, you know, through maybe half his life, you know, maybe till he was 40 or something, 35, 40. But then after that, nothing. No practice, I mean, we used to see him. He would do this. He would do mantra with his hand. Not, you know, I have a mala that, you know, you do ram, 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 whatever. He was doing it through his digit. So we used to see him sitting there just doing this kind of a thing. So he, you know, and he was telling, he always said, you know, just Ram, take Ram's name and everything will be accomplished. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but he never, there was no lectures, there was no talks, there was no nothing. It was just instant whatever was going on in the moment. Or, of course, we asked him questions.
Right.
And one famous one that my friend Krishna Das. I'm not sure if you know.
I met him. Like 4 or 5 months ago. He was in Sweden.
Yeah. You met him. Yeah. Oh, great. Yeah. So we were in India together from that time. We've been good friends for a long, long time. And so, we used to sit around there. Everyone thinks, wow, you're with this incredible being. Wow, every day must have been just this glorious fun fest, right? Of bliss. Not, because it was such an incredible mirror,
yeah.
Right? That you really saw the junk. I mean, it was horrifying and depressing. Okay.
For sure, yeah.
He and I used to go by the river and just bemoaning our fate. Oh, we're pieces of shit. How did we even, you know, that kind of thing, you know, all the self-deprecation stuff. So,
I mean, one thing I remember from the whole Krishna Das, it was a 4-hour, he was talking, he was answering questions, and we were chanting and singing. And I remember him being very, and I appreciate that. I think the whole blissfulness is kind of overrated. I like the gritty,
real,
raw spiritual work.
Yeah.
And I believe one of the first things he said was to, and it was a bunch of, you know, blissy people in the crowd. He said, well, one of the reasons I am here is that I didn't kill myself. I think me and my friend Amanda, we were like laughing our asses off, and some really? People took offense and some people laughed. I don't know. But then that's something that, I mean, when you say something like that, that creates, for me at least, that creates confidence. I trust you.
Trust,
When you show up in that kind of rawness, I mean, that's one of the keys to getting my trust.
Yeah, and that's what Ram Dass is all about. That's why you cannot believe the tsunami that has come through us, through the foundation, Ram Dass's foundation, which represents his work, and Neem Karoli Baba, and the Buddhists that we interface with a lot. I mean, it's overwhelming what happened. I knew Ram Dass meant so much to so many people, but this was beyond. I mean, like little things like the Instagram account of Ram Dass went up maybe almost 200,000 people in the first 10 days that he was gone. Mm. I mean, that's how enormous it was, you know. I think one of the things that I said in a little piece that I wrote and that is put out on Instagram was, aside from the incredible family that he introduced us to, aside from the satsang, sangha, community, which is core for anybody to be able to move forward, is a group that is a one-purpose, like-minded group. Aside from that, aside from the heart wisdom and everything, it was him saying, you know what? It's okay to fuck up. It is. It's okay, you know? And we don't have to be killing ourselves because of the dark thoughts, because of the screwy motivations that we have, because of our self-interest that we see. It's okay. Mm. So that okay was a big okay for people because we spend a lot of time, you know, with that judge. That judge has got that, you know, the court is in session on a 24/7 basis, you know? So I think that's really key to what Ram Dass represents. And that all comes from Neem Karoli Baba. You know, it's no BS, you know. It's really grounded stuff. I mean, it's like people would say, Maharaji, how can we get enlightened or raise our kundalini and all that? You know what he'd say? Feed people. Okay. No. Here's the secret mantra that'll get you there. Feed people. Yeah. Love Ram Dass. Love people and tell the truth.
Yeah. Be of service.
Yeah. Exactly. That's how you're going to get there. And then the other thing I was going to say, because that's what reminded me of Krishna Das, that he's abducted my story, which was I said to Maharaji, I figured it's the second or third time I was with him. I figured you're with a Hindu guru. Get a mantra. What else, right? I said, well, but I put it, how should I meditate I said. So you would expect them to say, do Ram, Ram, Ram all the time, and you'll... He said, meditate like Christ. When he was nailed to the cross, he felt no pain, only love. He was lost in love with every sentient being. I was like, what? First of all, I'm Jewish. I don't know who Christ is. In fact, I was in school, and the people in the Holocaust were my teachers, and they used to say Christ is bad. I mean, I had no idea of Christ whatsoever being brought up. And of course, I was brought up in a Catholic province in Quebec. And then Ram Dass came the next day, and I said, Ram Dass, he told me to meditate. Like, Christ, can you talk to him? You have a more convivial relationship. I was like in awe in one way. And he said, sure. So we went back the next day, and Ram Dass said, Maharaj, you said to meditate like Christ. So how did Christ meditate? So Maharaj, like, closed his eyes and just sat up. And then there was silence. It was me, Krishnadas, Ram Dass, and a couple other people. And we were, you know how it is when you're with your parents maybe and something goes wrong or there's something happening with, and there's, if they start to cry, you're like, huh? Tears started coming down from his eyes. And he opened his eyes and he went, you just don't understand. You don't understand. He never died. You don't understand. He lives in everyone's heart. He's lost in love with every sentient being. And he went on from there, and we had darshan of whatever that is. It's the same thing. It's the thing that's in him, the thing in Buddha, the thing in Dalai Lama, whatever. It's the same thing. And we then I had an appreciation of reality that I had never had before. And the other thing, and he would do, there's only one. It's called, in Hindi, it's subek. He'd look at us and go, Subek, there's only one, okay? Krishna, Ram, Buddha, Hanuman, one. So we started to then understand on a much deeper level, at a very young age, a bit of what truth is.
When I listen to your podcast, the mind-rolling podcast, I really appreciate it. I just heard the episode with one of the episodes with Duncan Trussell.
Yeah. Have you gotten to him? You should have him on this thing.
Oh, I've contacted him. Yeah. I will again. He's amazing. He's a great inspiration, not only for his sense of humor and his poetic. I mean, I don't even know where to start to describe that guy's brain, but it's like a mix between Ram Dass and an episode of Rick and Morty. It's like really amazing and cartoonish. So I heard you talk to Duncan, and also I'm really fascinated about the whole concept of mind rolling, and I would love for you to expand on that, because it reminds me a lot of what I want to explore with the art of conversation. Mm-hmm. So just please introduce us to the concept of mind rolling and what that means to you.
Slightly embarrassing, because mind rolling is a Tibetan tradition. That's not even the right word. There's a lama who's a woman, Khandro Rinpoche, incredible teacher, speaks perfect English. Is in Europe a lot. She's somebody, if you can ever get around to. And she represents that, the mind-rolling tradition, which is, God, I don't even know I can't remember the exact definition, but it's something like revealing the truth of who we are. Basically it. Sorry. So I first started this with a friend of mine named David Silver, who I've done a lot of stuff with over the years. He's worked with me on some different Ram Dass projects, but he's worked with everyone from the Beatles to Bob Marley. I mean, he's amazing, a doc director and writer. So I said, let's do this thing. Let's try and get to revealing who we are and letting everyone know who we still maybe believe who we are, and share that with people. And let's do it around consciousness, around the culture, around whatever it is that can help people get to a life in balance on a day-to-day basis. Whatever we can do to support and serve that. And in fact, later on, I did a series, an online course called Life in Balance. So I'm fortunate to have some fantastic teachers like Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein and Roshi Joan Halifax. Just an amazing array of people we've been friendly with for these decades alongside of Ram Dass. And we took these excerpts of life kind of teachings, very practical, talking about no woo-hoo, new age bullshit whatsoever. That's what, I mean, I'm more interested in my own life. I love the Tibetan traditions, the Buddhist traditions. And Maharaji was, although he was Hindu, and he certainly introduced us to like Hanuman, who he said was exactly the same as Christ. It's all about service, right? One day, I was with Krishnadas, and he had a bum knee. And I helped him get over to the ashram because he wanted to see Maharaji. And Maharaji said, "Boy, you're a good friend. You brought him all the way here," fully knowing that, although I was a good friend and I did want to help him, it was just a good excuse to get in front of him. And he knew that, you know, all that motivation, you know. So then he got up and he said, "Okay, just sit here." And he went off with somebody, and then he was just in the courtyard, and then he started limping. And Krishnadas goes, "Oh, Jesus, can you believe he's probably taken this on?" And sure enough, Krishnadas was fine. He sat down, and then suddenly Krishnadas didn't have a knee problem. But then Krishnadas had a diary, and in that diary, he had a little excerpt from Mahamudra, a great Buddhist text. And Maharaji asked the translator to translate, so they read a bit of it, and he went, "Teek. Bahotach, very good, it's right on," whatever that was. And then he flipped the page and there was a picture of him. And he said to us, "Who's that?" And we go, "Yeah, you're trying to josh with us or something. It's you." He goes, "Nay, Buddha." And I'll never forget that, because so many of us from that time on became involved with Buddhist teachings. Particularly, somebody, if you make it back east, is Danny Goleman, who wrote Emotional Intelligence. I mean, he would be a great person to talk to as well. You know, he's close to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and so on, and many of us in one way or another. So that has always been a grounding thing mixed with the bhakti thing, with the yoga of devotion, that you were at that concert with Krishnadas.
Yeah.
And you obviously saw people just open up with, he's just doing his practice. That's why he's way different than any of the other people are doing this kind of a thing. There's that performance thing. He's sitting there and doing his practice. You come on the ride, no problem. Don't, no problem.
He'll do it anyway.
Yeah, yeah, he'll do it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so that mixture of these two things, which we do in Maui, these retreats we have in Maui, they include Jack and Sharon, you know, all of our Buddhist friends alongside. So it's the mix of the yoga of the heart with the Tibetan Buddhist wisdom is a really powerful one.
And I just want to get back to the mind rolling concept. If you could, you know, describe that as a practice. Is it a practice as well?
It is, in that there isn't anything that isn't a practice, you know. I mean, me sitting here with you right now is a practice, you know. I mean, stuff is coming up. I have mindfulness about it, how I'm saying things, you know, motivation, tone. So everything is a moment-to-moment practice, no doubt about that. And with mind rolling, I mean, I love meeting people. I have such a good time with that. And at the same time, I'm looking for us to investigate a way that we can make this as practical as possible, you know, down to earth as possible. These Eastern teachings, which can be very esoteric and very difficult for people to really use.
Yes.
I mean, unless you, you know, go sit Zen for 10 years in Japan or whatever, you know. So that is a mission for me, a strong one. That's just who I am. I mean, I like to be really practical about all of this. So, and then people say to me, well, you were in India with this, you know, enlightened being and all of that. Yeah. But here I am, right here and now. And actually, he said to us, Maharaji, I've done everything for you, which to me meant he opened up the whole doorway, okay, and we walked through it. Okay, but there's one thing he said, I leave the mind to you, right? And that's any of us that have had an experience of divine presence, whatever it is, an alternate, take on consciousness, we all, you know, we just have, we've got it. Once you have that, it could be through a piece of music like it was with me with John Coltrane. As I said, through a psychedelic, through reading a book, through hearing something, anything can wake us up. And you have that awoken moment. And that is, then you're there. Mm. You just got to trust that, right? And that trust leads to something bigger, faith, which has no mental stuff going on to it. And then you got to deal with this mind, okay? It's a very, the mind and ego is a very bad master, but could be a good servant, right? Is what the Eastern teachers say to us.
Mm.
So mind rolling really, for me, is that experience of bringing that consciousness into us in a way that we can practically deal with our day-to-day lives, not some... Okay, I want to go to India and meet an enlightened being and everything will be okay. You know, none of that bullshit. It's right here and now. And because of the internet, it's all available to us. These right. teachings are all available to us. So certainly podcasts are one major way this is happening. I see it with the Be Here Now Network and all the podcasters we have on it. I mean, the growth is phenomenal, you know.
When I heard the term... It sparked something in me, and I always try to think in images and metaphors help me to understand more, like the more abstract concepts. So when I heard the term of mind rolling, I thought of it like, so walking through life is and believing in who you are is wearing a pair of shoes.
Yeah.
And you think that that's the only pair of shoes you got, and they're glued to your feet.
Yeah.
And then something happens. You listen to John Coltrane, or you go to like Vipassana, as I did, and you get a slap in the face, and you drop your shoes, and all of a sudden you're standing there with no shoes on. Mm. And what happened to me and a lot of people I talk to is that you're desperately seeking to find another pair of shoes. It's like, oh, these pair of shoes didn't work, so now I need to find another pair of shoes. And you do that, and I did that. I found another pair of shoes, and I just started all over.
Mm, yeah.
And then I got rid of those, and I was, bare feet again, and I kept looking for another pair of shoes until I didn't. And I just went, wait a minute. What if I don't wear shoes? And that to me, I mean, talking about the rawness and the, also the darkness and all these, you know, this self, inner voice mastery or inner voice negotiation.
A lot of negotiation, yeah.
It was like I went to this retreat with Adyashanti in the fall in Holland, and he told me that. So... what happens if you respond to that voice and call it sweetheart? And that really changed things up for me. And because that voice wants me or is so startled by me walking with no shoes on. It wants me to, you know, decide, like, are you this or are you that? Are you wearing high heels or sneakers? And not choosing, not deciding, not believing in that illusion of choice. That's what I think about when I think about mind rolling.
Yeah.
It's like when people try to put things on you, or you try to put those labels on yourself, you know, just rolling and not choosing is
I mean, for us, the practicality of that name is moving along and not getting stuck. And just exactly, in fact, I'll take that definition and redo our bio with it, okay? That's great, great, great. Yeah, but that is it. Absolutely, that is it. By the way, I did a podcast with Adi Ashanti, actually. If you like him, it's a good podcast.
Yeah.
I love him. He says at one point, when he was growing up as a boy, he couldn't understand why all these, the adults around him, there was always this kind of, it was intense stuff, anger, this, that. I don't get it. He kept thinking to himself. Then we got a little older. He said to himself, and this is like, I think a 9 or 10 year old. He said, oh, I know. These people really believe in their thoughts. That's it. That led him into meditation, right? For many, many years. I mean, he killed himself trying to meditate his way through this until, I don't know if you know his story.
Yeah, for sure.
Where he said, okay, screw it. I'm not doing this anymore. And as soon as he let go, he had an awakened experience. Yeah. He's a wonderful guy.
He is, and he's also, I mean, when you talked about the that kind of presence, I mean, spending 5 days with him was something.
Yeah, no, I said to him, you know, I think this, because I have a problem with the non-dual folks, that the people that they're, you know, lecturing to and so on. I mean, many of them, I feel, are just miss the boat because they just get into their head. You're already there. It's in you. It's present all the time. You just need to connect with it. Oh, good. I'm connected. Next. You know, I'm being very simplistic and I'm being slightly negative, which I am, about this stuff. And I said to him, so this non-dual thing, you know, what? He said, you know, when I started teaching, I didn't even know what non-dualism was. You know, it was just about being present in a way that people aren't. And he very much, grace is something to him, which is outside of non-dual thought. Heart is something to him. So he's a unique combination, Adi Ashanti.
I mean, something else that sparks my curiosity is how we talk about and the whole layer of psychedelics connected to the work, like to the practice of it. And different people have different opinions and different triggers about the subject. And I'm really curious about what you see and what your thoughts are about psychedelics connected to this spiritual work.
Well, it's what we were told. I mean, you know the story of Neem Karoli Baba, where Ram Dass gave him a bunch of acid?
I know the story, but I would love for you to tell it.
Well, when he was there the first time, Maharaji said, you have some medicine? And Ram Dass, yeah, I've got some aspirin. He must have a headache or something. He said, night, the yogi medicine. Right, acid? He goes, so he gives him some, and he takes it. Nothing happens, right? But then he goes home to America for a couple of years before he went back, and that's when we all went back the second time. And he thought, Jesus, I don't know. He threw those pills, and maybe he threw them. Maybe he threw them to the side. I'm not sure. And he had all this doubt in his mind. So he goes back. Of course, Neem Karoli Baba said, got any more of that medicine? Ram Dass was well prepared with some really good Owsley.
He gave him a lot, right?
Yeah, Yeah, more than you. I mean, especially the second time.
Yeah.
Like it was a bunch. And he put them in his palm, Ram Dass had, and Maharaji went like this. He took each individual pill, opened his mouth, he put the pill on. Did I do it right? Right, you know, knowing that Ram Dass had all this doubt. Anyhow, in the end, nothing happened again. And he said, this is good for beginners. It gets you to have Christ darshan for a couple of hours, but then you have to come back down. Best to feed people and love people.
Yeah.
But he did say it was good for a beginner. So in all of these years, so many people still, I mean, they're all around. Like the people that work for the foundation are mostly in their 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some that are, but not many, a couple that are older than that. And Be Here Now and Acid. It's quite a combo
yeah.
that opens the door for these people.
I read somewhere, someone was quoted, I don't remember who it was, but the quote was something along, using psychedelics for spiritual work is trespassing in God's garden. And to me it's that's
is it a fundamental Christian who said that?
No, it seems very like judgy and
slightly.
And I appreciate so there is a truth to that, but there's also
what's the truth to that? And I'm not like going around advocating acid. Let me tell you.
I would say the truth to it is that it's a visit to God's garden. I mean. It's not trespassing, but it's a visit, and mm-hmm. I call it like a digital field trip to human potential, but it's just a field trip. It's not the real practice, but it's a part of it. And I think it was I heard James Fadiman talk to a Buddhist teacher, and he asked him about the tradition of psychedelics within the Buddhist community, and also. Microdosing psychedelics and combining that with meditation and spiritual work. And I think it was the Buddhist teacher who said that, well, spiritual work is waking up, getting your equipment and your backpack on and walking the path up the mountain, and it's a lonely path. And you see others like if you look to the side, you can see other people walking their paths. But you need to walk your own path with whatever that entails, and carry your luggage up that mountain. Well, that's a spiritual work. Just okay.
Yeah. I love those Buddhists.
And using psychedelics is just for a moment, you go in this chopper and you go to the top of the mountain and you breathe that air and you see the view and you enjoy that. And then you go back down and you do the work. You do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that perspective or that fresh mountain air could give you some energy or some inspiration or almost like a map to know what roads to walk up mm-hmm. the mountain, but it's not the actual walking. And that seems fine to me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I'll buy that, but I would also, I would give it a little bit more credence in terms of when you have that experience, you are certainly in that moment living in a truth that you have not known before, especially mm-hmm. if it's the first time.
Yeah.
That never leaves. I mean, that is going to be there. Even though, as you said in a different way, the psychedelic experience is a reflection of the truth, right? Until you are 24/7 there, it is not the truth.
Yeah.
But even that reflection, as you say, it gives you the inspiration, it gives you the idea that of being courageous to really do the work that's necessary, you know. And to me, we're not looking at enlightenment, you know. This is bullshit. We're looking at how about being kind,
yeah.
you know, to people and compassion. you know, how about trying to see in this movie at one point, the Becoming Nobody movie with Ram Dass, at one point, I love this part of the movie. He just says, when is what you want enough? When is what you need, or he says it actually, when is when, what do I want enough? When is what do I need enough? It's much more interesting in life to say, what can I do to help you?
Yeah.
You know, and I love that. And that's where we want to get to. Forget, you know, levels of consciousness and moments of bliss and experience. I mean, some of the biggest problem with psychedelics in my mind is that it's such a fabulous experience, especially the ayahuasca thing, which is so popular, you know, in Western culture. I mean, do it and do it and keep doing it for what? What, you know? And some people say, well, I find more out about myself through the trip and so on. I'll tell you a crazy story, and it just popped in my mind. A young man that I met in India, because we do sometimes take people to India on yatras, pilgrimages, he said, I actually met him in an airport, and he said, I got to talk to you. I said, okay. And he tells me his whole story. He was doing these ayahuasca ceremonies, and he got so out there that the shaman decided to, he was going to make him a shaman, 22, 3-year-old kid. Mm. And so he was in training to do that. In that process, you know, I don't, when you do an ayahuasca trip, you have, you know, your, shall we say, consultants come, entities that come to you and advise you. Yeah. Usually it's two. He said, some reason I had three. And the third one was always right. The other two, not so much. He came to know that was Neem Karoli Baba appeared to him. This is an Indian guy from Toronto, young kid, whose parents had nothing to do with Maharaja whatsoever. So how that happened, we have no idea, which happens all the time. And he saw through his desire for constant experiences, and he actually left it. But before he left it, the reason he contacted me, because he was told by Maharaji, translate Miracle of Love, which is Ram Dass's great book from the 70s of all of people's experiences with Neem Karoli Baba in India, mostly Indians. Hmm. And it was, and of course, Spanish, there's so many people, you know, who speak Spanish who are really, of course, interested and live in America, you know. So anyhow, he gave it to me. He did it, and he gave it to me to publish, okay? And I said, we're doing that. We're going to actually publish. This comes out of an ayahuasca thing that he had darshan of Maharaji. I mean, talk about crazy. But anyhow, the reality of psychedelics is it's such a trap because that experience is so great. So it's a trap to continue to have. And, you know, you can tell yourself lots of stuff about, I'm finding out more. And maybe you are, you know, who knows? You know, I don't know anything, except I do see people that are trapped. And, you know, they'll be trapped as long as it's necessary until you wake up like this kid did and go, okay, I don't need to be doing that. So,
I mean, anything could be a new pair of shoes.
Yeah, anything. Right? Anything. So, but this is very, very compelling.
It is. I mean, I see that phenomenon even in the spiritual community where people create a new identity of being a seeker.
Yeah, right.
Well,
big bypass.
Yeah, but I mean, if you create a new identity by being a seeker, you'll never find it, right? Because you need to keep seeking, or you keep being a fan of this or this guru.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, Jed McKenna. Jed McKenna. Yeah.
Oh,
he's not related to Terrence or
his brother. No,
it's I think it's a pseudonym. Some people believe that it's an alter ego created by Adi Ashanti to be able to be playful, but I'm not sure. So My favorite books with Jed McKenna is the Spiritual Incorrect Enlightenment trilogy. And
is it Jeb or Jed?
Jed.
J-E-D.
J-E-D. McKenna. You should definitely look him up. He is like, you know, in the same tradition as I would say, Gurdjieff or
oh, really?
Osho. Like really funny and kind of trickster-like.
Uh-huh.
And he makes fun of the whole spiritual community, but is still very, very on point. So he talks about the guru trap. And he says that you could actually take all the questions that the students ask the guru and narrow it down to one. They're actually asking one question, and the guru is giving one answer. And the question is, am I doing this right? And the guru says, yes.
Because, or no.
Or no. I mean, but in his idea of the guru was like that there's so the fake guru says yes, because that guru wants the gig.
Yeah.
He wants you to come back to him as a set of shoes, like as an identity of a seeker. The guru needs the crowd, and the crowd needs the guru, and that's the guru trap.
Mm.
Like a real guru or a real enlightened being doesn't want you to do anything, doesn't want you to come back or to be there. So there's all these traps. I mean, you need to if you want to use the mind rolling metaphor again. You could get stuck in the community as well.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And that's where the bypass stuff comes in. You're just taking that ego, and now you're a spiritual ego, you know. But you know what? For everybody, it's just got to play out. You know, you look at people and you go, "Boy, you're stuck there. Ayahuasca, you're taking that, you're going every weekend on a quest. Oh, you know, you're going to be a chanter now because maybe you were rock and roller and earlier in your life that didn't work out. Now you can do that."
Yeah.
You know, whatever way it is, and there's plenty of them, right? And maybe it's a friend and you see it happening, right? You see clearly and you'd like to say something, and maybe you will, which maybe will create a something for that person to be able to drop those shoes, as you put it. On the other hand, for the most part, how do you just sit back and just love that person and allow them to be and not project what it is, even though most probably you're right, they're stuck somewhere. I see this all the time. I have a terrible time not backing off, I can tend to be a little bit cynical about especially the new age kind of thing, you know. I had a record company in L.A. in the 90s and 2000s. It was like part of the reason I had it was devoted to counter new age music. It was all about world beat music, substantial music. Meanwhile, these people were making a fortune, and I was like slogging through. You know, we did okay, but, you know, that was my idea of I'm going to show them, you know, so... There's so many ways that we every day act out these different scenarios that create a persona that we are comfortable with that kind of fend off all of the darkness.
Yeah.
And how to allow that to be. I mean, Ram Dass, again, I keep referring to this movie. It's a bit of a commercial sort of, but it is great, actually. And he says, I bumped into an old professor friend of mine, and this is after he was Ram Dass and all of that, from Harvard, and he says to Ram Dass, "You know, Dick, you haven't changed at all." Everything. And he said, "Yeah, the reality is all of these neurotic, I'm just as neurotic as I ever was, but those neuroses have become like little schmooze." And that is truth. And so that gives us a little bit more space to, it's okay, we're human, we're going to screw up, no problem. You know, at the same time, you know, aim for, you want to raise Kundalini, as Maharaji said, feed people and love them.
Yeah. I mean, I 6 years ago, I met this man. His name is Bjorn. And he,
Bjorn Borg, no.
Not Bjorn Borg, no. We have several.
I'm a big tennis fan, so.
Oh, yeah, cool. So this Bjorn is, I consider him to be my big brother. He left Sweden when he was 25 and went to Thailand and joined the monks connected to the forest monk tradition.
Yeah, like Jack Kornfield, that's his tradition.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he was practicing Buddhism there for 17 years. So he just left a really successful position as a manager at a huge Swedish corporation, and he was doing really good, but he wasn't satisfied or felt that his life was going in the direction he wanted to. And he always tells me that you can you could be enlightened and you can go to like monasteries or temples and retreats, but It's that weekend when you go back home and meet your parents. That mirror,
famous.
That mirror is harsh, man. And when I met Bjorn, I had this image of someone being awakened or being like this spiritual mature person. And I was kind of disappointed because he was so whiny and neurotic and anxious. I was like, oh no, I was wrong. He's not mature. He's not this, he's not that. But during the years, I really learned to appreciate that. And he taught me so much about, you know, allowing those parts in myself as well.
Fabulous.
And now I look back and see that as a gift, as him being so whole as a human being and allowing not only himself but also allowing me to be more of me. And he says every time I'm anxious or stressed or neurotic, he just laughs and kisses me on the cheek and welcomes that. And that helped me a lot to be able to invite those parts of myself as well.
I mean, it sounds just like my experience when I first met Ram Dass. Just allowed me to be okay with all of that, all of those parts of us that we constantly are judging or ashamed of, you know, all of the things that we do. So,
and that makes me curious. How was it for you when you met Neem Karoli Baba and you came back to your mom and dad? How was that experience? How did they? Did they have any fears or triggers?
I said, Mom, my name's Raghu now. Do not call me Mitchell ever again. Some crazy bullshit that I put on her. And I'm poor mother. But, you know, in the end, every member of my family, my mother, my father, my brother, my sister, their partners, was with Neem Karoli Baba. My mother with Siddhi Ma after, who was a great saint that Maharaji left for us and just left 2 years ago, actually. My entire family are devotees. So I had a very unusual experience that way.
Wow.
Right? It wasn't like going home, you know, like Ram Dass went home and, oh yeah, Rum Dum's back, you know, that kind of a thing. I mean, he ended up having a fabulous relationship with his father, more when he was moving towards death and all that. But no, my experience is so far off. I mean, actually, it's funny because I just had somebody going through memorabilia since Ram Dass has left. We're trying to really make sure we catch all of that and scan it, you know, get it all straightened out, because we'll have eventually a traveling exhibit of Be Here Now Ram Dass, and then maybe it'll go into a big library and all of that. So we're working on that. And it's not just Ram Dass. I had all of these incredible letters that she found, and I found one to my father It was just extraordinary. It had stuff in it I didn't even remember, you know, that referred to what I'm actually doing now in terms of moving. I moved to back to California, to Ojai, and we're setting up a center there for the foundation and so on. It's all happening. And in this letter, he said that to me.
Who wrote the letter?
I wrote the letter to my father.
To your father.
Maharaji just said, what are you going to do when you go back to America? Are you going to go back into the radio? I go, no, I'm not going to do the radio. I want to set up a satsang center. Now that's happening. 50 years later, some crazy shit, right? Amazing. Of course, I did go back into radio when I went back. God, so much stuff. I mean, you know, we start talking and, you know, all this stuff starts to flow through and these remembrances of all of these moments that I have to go back to Ram Dass, like when I mentioned some of the things that he had given, and one of the great ones was just what you got from your friend. It's okay to be human, basically. That's what we're talking about. Stop killing yourself about that. That's a huge thing. We are doing that day to day, you know. I mean, it's a very tough, tough thing. Because it's easy to think your way out of it. And I have to say, you know, everyone, like, practice. You got to practice to leverage, you know, the leverage that your mind has on you. You've got to practice, you know, getting a crowbar in there and, you know, moving that out a little bit. And that is meditation. It is chanting. It is asanas. It is pranayama. It's all of the things that we have access to in one tradition or another.
I mean, for people who are listening right now and feel a bit distanced to the Eastern culture and philosophy, how would you translate that into a modern Western context? Mm-hmm.
That's what mind rolling is trying to do on a day-to-day basis. But forget, you know, everybody who's listening. I mean, the only way you become interested in anything that might transform your life is because you're suffering, okay? We are suffering. You get to the point where it's just too much depression, too much addiction, too much separation, too much aloneness, you know, whatever it is. It boils down to suffering. You are going to make a move because of that. That's one level. Another is, it is written, folks, you know, if somebody like a Neem Karoli Baba or an Adyashanti who, you know, is a very aware, is not in the same league, but is a totally aware person, they're, suddenly you're going to be aware of them. And something, you're going to go to a talk. Something's going to happen. So it's just through the suffering, where does that first inkling of trust come? And that trust is in the intuition inside each one of us, okay, that knows this is what I need right now because I am so unhappy. You know, I mean, I was so unhappy as a teenager, into, you know, all the way into, you know, 20 years old, 21, you know, and then I had music. I keep remembering this now. That was the most important thing to me, you know, which is why I do a lot of chanting and mostly private. I don't, you know, Krishnadasa does, he takes care of that publicly in terms of representing what we do. But, you know, I have to say that whatever it is that anybody out there, you are going to, something is going to come to help you if you just ask. And you can, and you don't have to think of God or anything, just through a trust of a something. It could be that psychedelic trip. It could be that book you read. It could be Naveed's podcast. Something, bang, right. And then the best thing to do that I know of, practice-wise, is getting together with other people who want to move forward out of the shoes that you keep referring to as a great analogy, you know. And we can all be barefoot in this space together. And so we do these retreats. I can't tell you how fantastic they are in Maui and California and India. Now we're going to do them all around the country. Yeah. Hopefully, you know, we'll start doing that. I can't tell you the importance of them. I can't tell you how the way people walk in and are able to just let go of those shoes. They really do. They take off their shoes because we make them, but in another way, they're taking them off because they want to. We want that. We want to be able to share, you know, this heart, this one heart. I mean, there's no doubt about it, you know. We're doing it right now. I mean, I don't know you from Adam and or Jill, and here we are, and this space is being created because we care. Mm. That's all it takes. So getting together with like-minded people, in whatever way, a Buddhist meditation, a Zen meditation, a Sufi dance, it doesn't matter what it is.
Right,
they all go up. I mean, you talked about going up to the going up the mountain. The Buddhist thing is we have a solitary thing here. You know, this is up to you. You know, there's a little too much of that for me in that. But yeah, we are all going on different paths up the mountain to get to the same place.
Yeah, I agree. I really appreciate the group and the collective and the community more and more. Mm. When I first came back from retreats, I was alone. I was I almost felt tricked. Like I went to this retreat, I got a glimpse of something good, and I came back, and there was no one to connect to. But that also inspired me to invite people to create that kind of community, and to reflect on what kind of relationships I had. Mm. But that's the main thing right now. It's the tribe.
Is that happening in where you live?
Oh yeah, I mean Sweden is cooking.
Really?
For sure. Yeah, and it's a mix between the burner community, the psychedelic community, and the tantric community. So those three communities are merging, and something really really inspiring is happening with teachers like Byron Katie, Adyashanti, Ram Dass, and you know all these really interesting people. But it's a new crowd. It's a new crowd of entrepreneurs, hipsters, techies, and it reminds me of what's happening in here in LA and San Francisco and California, but also in other parts of the world. Mm. So
that's great.
I feel
that's
hopeful.
Really great,
for sure.
I want to come visit.
You should. You're so welcome. We would love to host you.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
So the Mind Rolling podcast is on YouTube and also as a podcast.
It's on YouTube. It's, of course, on Apple. It's on wherever podcasts are distributed worldwide. But you can go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. There's about a dozen or so of us up there, including I do one where I introduce Ram Dass. Mm. Krishna Dass, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph
Trussell,
Duncan. No, Duncan is not on the network. Duncan's on his own.
He's on a comedy podcast. Network.
But he's we are good friends, and we do a lot of stuff together, and we have a great time. Yeah, Pete Holmes, I get in a lot. Pete, you know, these are people that have been coming to the retreats in Maui, basically, and in Ojai, and just being part of the family, you know. Mm. And we'd love for you guys to come too, by the way.
We would love to come.
And we'll talk about that.
I really appreciate our conversation. I know you need to go soon, but in the end of every episode, we ask our guests to recommend someone they would like to hear on the podcast. So who would you like us to invite here?
On your podcast?
Yeah.
Good. Narrow it to one?
Oh, you can mention several.
If you can... There's a Tibetan Lama named Mingdjur Rinpoche, who is one of the great lamas that is in, and he's a young guy, you know, maybe 45 now, who at one point, he comes from one of the most exalted family of lamas. His father's name is Tulku Urgyen Rinpoche. Everybody get his bio. There's a biography that he wrote about his life that's spectacular. Had four sons. I don't know one of them, but I know three of them. They are all extraordinary lamas. Mm. But he, being the youngest, a number of years ago, he left his monastery. He was the head of several monasteries in India, in North India and in Nepal. And he left that monastery, and he just said... He jumped the wall. He didn't tell anybody except his father. And he went off for 4.5 years as a sadhu without no money, no nothing, because he wanted to experience what he is without the trappings. Mm. And he almost died. He got food poisoning, and he almost died. He actually had an NDA, a near-death experience. He is extraordinary. His book, what's his book called? In Love with the World.
Can you say his name again?
Mingyur Rinpoche. M-I-N-G-Y-U-R Rinpoche.
Rinpoche.
Okay. And I did a podcast with him that I urge you to watch.
Oh, wow.
Krishnas and I did. Hmm. The level of just pure awareness in his face is extraordinary. And his whole thing is so practical and so incredible. Yeah. So he came to me. Of course, Duncan Trussell would be fun too.
That would be really fun.
I'll tell Duncan.
Yeah, I would love to meet them both. Thank you so much for being on the How Can We podcast, Raghu Marcus. I really appreciate
you. Thank you,
Navi. Really hope to see you in Sweden and Scandinavia soon.
Absolutely.
And we'll definitely
on my way to India one of these days.
Oh, for sure. It's just a shortcut to India.
Yeah.
So thank you so much.
Thank you.